Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Maybe the biggest news this year in cancer therapeutics is the sudden emergence of anti-PD-1, a monoclonal antibody, a so-called checkpoint inhibitor. In addition to very encouraging data in renal cell cancer and melanoma, a surprising data set was reported in non-small cell lung cancer, and I met with a key figure in this field, Dr. Julie Bramer, to discuss this fascinating development, and she began her conversation by commenting on the background to this work.
There actually are two different antibodies that have been studied in large groups of lung cancer, and these antibodies block the same pathway. The programmed death pathway is important for T cell inhibition. So typically cancers or other infections will actually express antigen. And so the T cells need two different signals to actually be activated in order to attack whatever's going on, either infection or cancer. So you have antigen expression that a antigen presenting cell is needed, and then the T cell recognizes that, and then you need a stimulatory pathway. Normally, your body uses these inhibitory or checkpoint pathways to actually prevent autoimmune syndromes such as rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or diseases like that. But the tumor actually co-opts this pathway and can express the ligand of this pathway, PD-L1. Thus, by expressing the ligand, actually the ligand will combine with the receptor on the T cell and block that action of the T cell and thus cause the inhibit the T cell from being activated, and the T cell usually goes away and dies.
So can you talk about the two antibodies and what we know about them at this point?
So the one I reported on at ASCO is the PD-1 antibody that actually blocks the receptor on the T cell. And right now that has shown the greatest activity and the most is known about that antibody in non-small cell lung cancer. Then what was reported in the New England Journal as well was another antibody to the ligand on the tumor, a PD-L1 antibody. The PD-1 antibody in the New England Journal and at ASCO blocks the receptor on the T cell. And certainly that trial is the most mature. And then the other antibody, which is an antibody to the PD-L1 or ligand of that pathway, was published in the New England Journal with me as the first author, with Scott Ticotti out of the University of Washington in Seattle. And he presented the phase 1 data at ASCO.
So let's talk a little bit about the research data, the clinical research data that you reported, particularly in lung cancer.
So these antibodies are extremely exciting in the fact that this is the first time that we've seen robust responses in patients with lung cancer with this type of therapy. Certainly vaccines have some history in lung cancer. We talked briefly about ipilimumab, but these antibodies have shown a response. So for the PD-1 antibody, the response rate in lung cancer in general, and these were reported in 76 patients on this trial with lung cancer, the response rate was roughly 18%. Now, if you broke it down by histology, and again, these are relatively small numbers, the patients with squamous cell histology had a response rate of approximately 33%, and the patients with non-squamous cell histology had a response rate around 11%. But what is important to realize is most of these patients were heavily pretreated. This was a phase 1 trial and allowed patients to have two prior therapies, up to five prior therapies, and the majority of the patients had three or more therapies. So the fact that we had a response rate and a response rate that was long-lasting is quite interesting, and for those people that take care of lung cancer patients is amazing. The progression-free survival in the patients that were followed for 6 months was approximately 20%, and the fact that these responses are maintained over time, and in my experience, longer than patients treated with chemotherapy, particularly those patients that are heavily pretreated.
Now, in your presentation, the spider plot, there was at least one patient that you actually commented on who got out, I think, about a year and actually stopped therapy and continued in response. How many people have there been like that?
So there are a handful of people. In the lung cancer group, certainly I would say a handful of patients are out beyond 2 years without needing therapy. Certainly, there's more patients with melanoma and kidney cancer in that group because they've been treated longer than most of the lung cancer patients on this trial. But on this trial, what happened is that you started on therapy, and if you had a response or stable disease, you were treated up to 2 years. And at that point, if your response was maintained, then you were stopped on therapy and followed for another year. And that one particular patient has been followed for a year after stopping therapy, and their disease had not grown.
Now, another thing on that spider plot, there's at least a couple of patients where the tumor got worse and then responded, and kind of gets into this whole issue of how do you do trials? How do you follow patients? I mean, this is even an issue with IPI right now and melanoma when you're using an immune-based therapy.
Exactly. And that's probably the hardest thing for most of us to grasp is to leave patients on a therapy while their disease is radiographically getting worse. In this trial, as well as other immunotherapy trials, we're moving towards an immune-related response criteria where patients are allowed to remain on study even though their disease is radiographically getting worse. Of course, these patients have to be clinically stable as well. And we do see patients' disease over time decreasing in size. Certainly, we have some patients where a new lesion is seen, so technically they'd have to go off a regular study, but on these studies they're allowed to remain on. And then we do see over time these tumors decreasing in size. We'll also see certainly disease increasing in size and then decreasing in size over time as well. And the thought is potentially that we're actually causing an infiltrate of T cells, and so this disease is at least radiographically getting worse, but the actual cancer is not.
I think you also referred to mixed responses, which of course can be seen with any kind of systemic therapy, but how often do you see that where, you know, some lesions are getting better, some are getting worse, and what do you think is going on?
You know, we know that tumors are heterogeneous and certainly may be out of the realm of being controlled by the immune system. You know, some very large tumors may be just too large for the immune system to be able to handle. So we may see a mixed response. And I think we're looking more and more about how other focal therapies might help control the disease while the immunotherapy is being able to control the disease elsewhere.
Let's talk a little bit about side effects and toxicity. And this has been a concern with ipilimumab. What was seen here?
So we did see immune-related toxicities. So these toxicities are different than what we see with chemotherapy. Pretty much anything that can cause an itis, these type of therapies can cause. So certainly colitis, hepatitis, hypophysitis, thyroiditis, these sort of therapies can cause these symptoms. Probably the most worrisome that was seen with the PD-1 therapy in a small number of patients, but you know, certainly we did have 3 patients who died due to this side effect. It's pneumonitis. And it's not clear the mechanism of action, but the thought is that it is truly immune-related. And in a lot of patients, it could be controlled with steroids or just stopping the therapy. But certainly in these 3 patients, even with doing that, the pneumonitis progressed and was related to their death.
I kind of got the overall feeling looking at these data that it seemed like it was pretty well tolerated. I mean, do most patients, I'm not going to say cruise through it, but really went through without any problems?
Correct. The most common toxicity that is seen is fatigue, so it's not clear if it's actually the antibody or having to come in for therapy every 2 weeks. But certainly if you talk with all of my patients who are on the trial, the side effects are much easier to tolerate than being on chemotherapy. Your blood counts don't drop. You don't lose your hair. You don't have much in the way of nausea. Diarrhea, again, is rare. So patients in general feel quite well on this, and that's part of the reason why these type of therapies can be given for a long period of time. Certainly, patients who developed thyroid disorders became either hypothyroid, which would be the most common. Of course, those sort of problems are easily treated with thyroid hormone replacement.
Now, is this a central mechanism, and do you see sort of hypophysitis?
Hypophysitis does not seem to be quite as common compared to with the ipilimumab. And again, for the most part, patients with hypophysitis, their hormones can be replaced. But certainly, you know, in the small number of patients compared to the ipilimumab data, we don't see quite the rate comparatively.
But with the hypothyroidism, the TSH is down or up?
It's usually the TSH is up and the free T4 is down.
So it's a direct effect on the thyroid?
Correct.
Interesting. What is the next step from a research point of view? I know there's, quote, phase three trials either being done or designed.
There's one trial that's out, I believe, on clinicaltrials.gov, and right now it's just for patients with squamous cell histology, and comparing the PD-1 antibody head-to-head with docetaxel. The thought is the response seen in squamous cell histology was robust enough to go directly to a phase three trial and compare it directly in the second line setting to docetaxel. That is one phase three trial. There's certainly a lot of phase one trials combining with this antibody with other types of therapies, such as chemotherapy and other therapies. And I know other companies are looking to evaluate these type of antibodies as well in lung cancer.
You know, this issue comes up in oncology all the time, that particularly when you see novel, relatively non-toxic agents that you can see clinical benefit of patients. I'm guessing you've got patients in your practice who you can look at and say, for example, this patient who continued on for a couple of years who benefited from therapy, in terms of at what point should an agent like that be available? How do you feel about this particular agent?
So I think until we're more comfortable with treating the side effects of these type of agents, I don't think these agents should be widely available. And I think we also need to have more information about biomarkers of response. Certainly our group out of Johns Hopkins and other groups are looking at whether or not tumors have to express PD-L1, the ligand for this pathway, to actually cause a response. Certainly, there's other antigens or mutations that may be associated with response or lack of response to this type of therapy. And I think until we have a clear direction about a biomarker, I don't think this type of agent will be readily available.
And there were some data presented at ASCO. I don't know the exact type of assay. Was that an IHC assay?
Yes. Right now, the assay is IHC-based and is done by hand, but there's other companies that are looking to automate this type of evaluation to see whether in a larger group of patients that this is consistent. And certainly, our data was relatively limited, was approximately 50 patients or less, where it seemed that the patients who had PD-L1 positive tumors were the only ones to respond, but that was not consistent. Only 36% of the patients who had PD-L1 positive tumors responded. So it's not 100% comparatively to, say, the ALK translocation with crizotinib, which is much closer to 100%. And I think of those 50 patients, there were only 10 patients with lung cancer within that biomarker group, and five of those patients had PD-L1 positive tumors, and one of those patients responded. So, you know, I think the data is just way too new, and I think we need to look at some of these automated IHC systems to see whether or not this is truly going to be the biomarker or not.
And there's also a PD-L2. Does that seem predictive at all?
So PD-L2 is a ligand that is mainly expressed on dendritic cells, and it is unclear how much that plays a role in solid tumors. It may play a bigger role in heme malignancies.
Anything else happening in terms of immune treatment, particularly of lung cancer? There's some vaccines or trials out there. Anything out there that you've got your eye on?
So there's at least five phase three trials with vaccines in lung cancer. You know, we're waiting for the Magritte trial data in the adjuvant setting where the MAGE-3 vaccine is being evaluated compared to observation. There are other trials in the maintenance setting, such as the phase three trial with the BLP vaccine after chemoradiation therapy in patients with stage 3 disease. And then there's some other vaccines that are being looked at in the maintenance setting after treatment with chemotherapy, such as the TD4010 vaccine, which has, I believe, just started a phase 3 trial in that setting. And I think all of these vaccines are extremely interesting, and certainly their phase 2 data give us a hint of the possibilities for these vaccines. I think potentially in the future, combining these vaccines with these type of antibodies, either ipilimumab or PD-1 or other antibodies that are being evaluated, may actually hold the key to unlocking or unleashing the immune system in this disease.
What about combining anti-PD-1 and ipilimumab?
So that is being evaluated in a phase 1 trial. I believe this is mainly up at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and they are combining the two therapies. And I can't speak to the data, but I believe they're including mainly patients with melanoma.
Can you just maybe provide a brief kind of broad perspective on what was seen with renal cell and melanoma, you know, comparable to lung cancer?
The responses in melanoma and renal cell carcinoma were actually more robust compared to the lung cancer data. Their response rate was 30% plus, and certainly there was, again, more data with those patients, but I'd say in the general gestalt of the data, there was more patients who were on the treatment for a longer period of time and then also in follow-up.
You know, one of the things we've heard, and I can remember hearing this when sipuleucel T and prostate cancer was talked about, is that, you know, with immune-based treatment, of course, that's a different mechanism. There needs to be more focus on long-term impact in terms of survival as opposed to response rate. Do you agree with that? And do you think that applies to anti-PD-1?
I think that is the case, though we are seeing pretty amazing responses that are probably equivalent to chemotherapy in some of our patients. But I certainly would not, I mean, it gives us a hint of activity, but I think the main goal of this type of therapy, again, is to improve progression-free survival and overall survival in these patients. And you can't really use the typical RECIST criteria to judge whether or not this type of therapy is going to work or not.
Right now, if a doc were to call you and say, wow, this, you know, anti-PD-1 stuff looks really great, is there any way to get a patient on a trial of that? Do you have active trials right now where you put patients on this drug?
So currently our active trials for PD-1 or PD-L1 antibodies are mainly limited right now to phase 1 trials. We have a phase 1 trial of a PD-L1 antibody from another company, and as well as a PD-1 plus an anti-interleukin antibody from another company. So we do have phase 1 trials that we're trying to get patients on, and these should be open over the next month. I will have the phase 3 trial for PD-1 versus docetaxel for patients with squamous cell, and hopefully over the next probably 4 months, more studies coming down the pike with these antibodies.
Now, does that phase 3 have a crossover?
No, it does not. The crossover is not allowed, but I would have to say, you know, there are other antibodies out there in phase 1 trials that may be available for those patients.
Let's talk about other developments in lung cancer research, starting out with EGFR mutations. Any comment on the LuxLung3 paper presented at ASCO on the irreversible EGFR TKI afatinib that showed superiority as first-line treatment of patients with EGFR mutations compared to cis-pemetrexed?
I think the LuxLung3 study data is extremely tantalizing, comparing, and you can't compare it directly head-to-head to some of the trials such as your attack work that compared TKIs versus chemotherapy. But I think, you know, some of the data showing progression-free survival is tantalizing, saying that potentially these are irreversible EGFR TKIs may actually keep patients from progressing for a longer period of time and certainly outdo chemotherapy in this treatment setting in patients with EGFR mutation.
In terms of patients with mutations, how do you approach the patient who has a good response to, for example, erlotinib and then progresses?
So that is the million-dollar question, and I have several patients, and that's actually one of my cases today. Typically, I try to find a clinical trial for these patients, and probably over the past 6 months, I've started biopsying these patients to really see whether or not their tumor has developed a T790 mutation, and there's particular trials just for that mutation, and there's other mechanisms of resistance that are being discovered as well, including MET amplification. And certainly trying to find a trial for these patients is important. Certainly, a lot of our patients are not mobile, and if we don't have a clinical trial that they'd be eligible for, I am in the camp with Memorial Sloan Kettering where I never stop erlotinib and start adding chemotherapy to it. Certainly, if patients are not tolerating erlotinib well, to begin with, I may stop erlotinib and just switch completely to chemotherapy. But I think some of the data that Memorial has presented in the past, such as their afatinib plus cetuximab data, where at first there was a long washout period and a lot of patients' disease progressed relatively quickly, and that's part of the reason why they shortened the washout period for that trial. where pulling off the erlotinib, they saw a rebound. And so trying to keep the tumor cells that are still responsive to the EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor, I think, remains important throughout the treatment of those patients. And again, I usually just add chemotherapy to it.
Just out of curiosity, right now, I mean, to me, the one thing I saw in the last couple of years that looked exciting was cetuximab and afatinib. I don't even know if there are trials out there that you can get patients on with that. But I mean, what kind of trials would you have at your place available right now for a patient progressing on erlotinib?
We certainly have trials for patients who have T790 mutations. We have one phase one trial combining two oral agents that may be able to block this. I know there are other trials out there with oral TKIs that actually bind to the pocket of the T790 mutation. So those are some interesting compounds as well. Certainly MET amplification, some MET inhibitors or MEK inhibitors may play a role in these patients as well. And I think in general, that's where the field is moving. Again, you know, 6 months ago, I probably wouldn't have biopsied these patients, but now I try to biopsy patients whose disease is progressing, who have previous EGFR mutations, and trying to find whether or not they're developing resistance mutations.
Anything new and exciting in terms of MET inhibition? We saw some data in the past on the monoclonal antibody MetMab, and then the TKI ARC-197. Is that tivatinib, I think? Anyhow, anything new with that strategy?
Certainly the large phase 3 trial looking at erlotinib plus or minus the MetMab antibody in patients whose disease is MET high certainly is tantalizing, and you know, we hope to see the data over the next year or two. And you know, I think we're seeing, like you said, very small groups of patients, specific patients that may benefit from these targeted agents, and I think the evaluation of just MET high patients is very important, particularly with this antibody. Some of the other MET inhibitors, certainly a lot of those inhibitors are not just specifically MET inhibitors, but inhibit various different tyrosine kinases. But I think we're seeing some activity at least reported in small trials with the Arcule drug. And then we're also seeing some trials being done with erlotinib plus the Arcule drug in patients with KRAS mutant tumors as well.
Let's talk a little bit about your patients, starting out with your 52-year-old patient.
So this first case is a 52-year-old previous smoker who presented with a cough and worsening shortness of breath over a 2-month period of time. After being treated with antibiotics for a couple rounds, a chest x-ray was done that revealed a right lung mass. The CAT scan showed a right lung mass as well as bilateral mediastinal adenopathy. So at that point, he had stage 3 disease. Then a PET scan was done and showed the same, but also two bone metastases. The bronchial biopsy was positive for squamous cell carcinoma.
So when I saw this case, I was thinking, I wonder if this is one of your PD-1 patients. No, huh?
Well, this type of story is certainly consistent with some of my PD-1 patients.
But it also then leads into the question, how do you manage the patient off study, and how would you generally think through options in this situation?
So in the first-line treatment setting, certainly we take into account histology to decide what type of therapy to start with. And certainly in this gentleman, I would stick with chemotherapy, and certainly being 52, I didn't mention the ECOG performance status, but his performance status would have been ECOG 1. And I think using combination chemotherapy would be important. Certainly in squamous cell carcinoma patients, our options would be, at least in my mind, gemcitabine, carboplatin, or cisplatin, as well as docetaxel, carboplatin, or cisplatin. I usually err on the side of using gemcitabine in this patient population and saving docetaxel for the second-line treatment setting.
So what actually happened with this man?
So this patient actually remained on chemotherapy and had a response, and he actually received 4 cycles, and certainly taking gemcitabine isn't always easy. He had a lot of aches and pains. He was ready for a break, but certainly we did discuss maintenance therapy, and in squamous cell carcinoma, we don't have a lot of options for maintenance therapy. In this patient, we did discuss erlotinib for maintenance, but when push came to shove, he was ready for a break. And we actually followed him for approximately 4 months, and his disease progressed. And then he went on to a second-line therapy, which was mainly docetaxel. And after 2 cycles, his disease actually progressed, and then he actually went on to the PD-1 antibody phase 1 trial.
So he did it, because I was thinking to myself, if I'm him, I'm wanting to get on that trial or something, you know, if that were me. So he actually went on it?
Yes, he actually went on it. Unfortunately, his disease did progress, and we did have to take him off the therapy. So certainly in these patients, it doesn't work for everyone.
And did he have any side effects or toxicity from it?
No, not this patient.
Anything new in terms of understanding the biology of squamous cell cancer, particularly in terms of mutations?
Over, again, the past 6 months, this field has exploded. You know, we saw a lot of presentations at ASCO from Dr. Govindan and colleagues coming out of Washington University looking at various different mutations. And I think also out of Dana-Farber, they've been able to demonstrate in their group of patients with squamous cell histology, they can see in about 50% of patients a particular mutation or amplification in these patients. And certainly a lot of trials are being directed towards those mutations that are found, such as the DDR2 mutation. There certainly are inhibitors such as dasatinib, clinical trials specifically for those patients as well. There's also a fibroblast growth factor receptor amplification seen in this group of patients, and there's inhibitors of that pathway. There's trials out there as well for those patients. So, you know, again, we're not even near what is known about adenocarcinoma, and we certainly haven't found the holy grail that erlotinib and gefitinib filled for those patients with EGFR mutations. But certainly we're learning more and more about squamous cell carcinoma. And I think, you know, over the next 2 years, 3 years, we're going to be treating squamous cell carcinoma patients the same way as adenocarcinoma patients, and we'll have a group of mutations that we routinely test as well.
So I guess coming up behind adeno and squamous is small cell. What do we know about that biologically in terms of mutations?
Certainly there's not enough known. I think things such as hedgehog inhibitors, as well as insulin-like growth factor receptor inhibitors, as well as ipilimumab is being evaluated in this treatment setting as well. But small cell lung cancer is limited because of mainly the patient numbers.
How about your 43-year-old lady?
So this 43-year-old lady who is never smoker presented to me with right-sided weakness, actually presented to the ER with right-sided weakness and progressive cough. MRI of the brain showed multiple brain metastases, and the CAT scan showed a right pleural effusion and bilateral small lung masses. She also was found on bone scan to have multiple bony metastases. Thoracentesis was positive for adenocarcinoma. And believe it or not, that thoracentesis had enough tumor tissue in it to actually evaluate for mutations. Certainly in this patient, the big question would be, how long could you wait for that EGFR mutation testing to come back before feeling like you need to start therapy? And I think that's always a question right now about how to handle some of these patients. Certainly, if her symptoms were progressing rapidly and I didn't have that test back, I would still fall on chemotherapy to try to control her disease and wait for that mutation test to come back. I don't feel comfortable just starting erlotinib when I don't have the mutation test back.
Although, you know, it's kind of ironic. I was just sort of thinking about the same kind of desperate situation, but breast cancer. In some way, we'd get a HER2 and ER done, I think, before they start therapy. Do you think we're getting there in terms of mutations for lung cancer, being able to get turned around quickly enough?
I think we're getting there. Certainly we are. And depending on, you know, a lot of institutions send these out to different companies and certainly are also developing ways to do, again, next-gen sequencing or evaluations much more quickly compared to a couple of years ago.
So I'm real curious to know whether you radiated her brain.
So her brain was radiated, and by the time that started, she was doing okay. We were able to control her pleural effusion through thoracentesis, and by that time, her EGFR mutation came back, and it was positive, so then we started her on erlotinib.
So if you had known that she was EGFR positive, do you ever hold off on brain radiation and just give the TKI?
certainly if she's not symptomatic from her brain metastasis, I probably would have held off on the whole brain radiation. But in her case, she was symptomatic and we needed to start that. Certainly there is data about erlotinib crossing the blood-brain barrier and definitely case reports showing that in patients with EGFR mutations, their brain disease can respond.
So what's her current situation?
So in current situation is kind of the situations that we've been talking about. After a year, her disease began progressing on erlotinib.
So she had a good response?
She had an excellent response to begin with, had great quality of life. We did have to dose reduce by 25 milligrams because of significant rash. And at the time of progression, she was not eligible for clinical trial at that point, and she didn't have disease that we could easily biopsy, and so we actually put her on pemetrexed and carboplatin. She did well again for 6 cycles, and her disease is progressing again. She actually, we're biopsying her to see whether or not she has a T790 mutation. In her case, though, I want to point out her disease in her brain progressed. And of course, a lot of us don't know what to do in those situations. And I consulted my colleagues across the U.S. and there is some data out there about pulsing erlotinib to see if you can get a response again in the brain. And we have tried that and her disease actually did respond.
Wow. So what was the dose and schedule you used in her?
So I'll take what someone would have normally taken for 4 days, and that's roughly, I believe, 700 milligrams, and then we'll pulse that, and then she'll wait 4 days and pulse it again in 4 days. Certainly, there's some other data pulsing even up as high as 1,500 milligrams of erlotinib and doing the pulsing that way to get a response. And I think there's some trials out of Dana-Farber that may be reported soon regarding this. And certainly, a lot of these patients also can develop leptomeningeal disease. And again, that's what we would try in those situations as well. Again, not great data out there, but I think we're seeing leptomeningeal disease, particularly in these patients. The longer they live, the more likely this type of problem presents.
So this lady had an objective response in the brain?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, which would be unusual.
That seems, I'm not sure I've kind of even seen that reported in terms of objectively. And she's still on the pulse?
Yes, we've left her on the pulse, and after we get the biopsy, hopefully we can find a resistance mutation and she wants to get on a clinical trial.
How did she do in terms of her skin on the higher dose?
Again, her disease continued to progress, so the pulse of the erlotinib did not seem to control the systemic progression, but has seemed to control the brain disease.
I meant the skin toxicity. You mentioned she had to be dose reduced initially.
Yeah, interestingly, on the pulsing, she didn't have the same type of skin toxicity. She had a lot more itching and dry skin, but not a whole lot of rash. So, you know, certainly depending on the patient, I've seen both more rash with the pulse or less rash with the pulse.
So, quick question I got from oncologist, 89-year-old woman, metastatic adeno, the lung, EGFR mutation positive, gets erlotinib, has a good response, and after 9 or 10 months is having progression. However, the patient's had absolutely no side effects of 150 milligrams of erlotinib. Would you dose increase?
You certainly can try to dose increase and increase to rash. We've looked at that in ECOG. And it does seem that patients who develop a rash may have longer survival, but certainly I don't think we have the data to say that pushing the dose will actually cause the disease to respond systemically. But certainly it could be tried. Particularly, I have a lot of patients that really do not want to go on to chemotherapy for various different reasons. Certainly in this patient, you know, even at her age, if she has a good renal function, I think she'd be able to tolerate pemetrexed easily.
Right. Yeah, I guess I should have qualified that the patient didn't want to receive chemo. How high would you go if the patient continued not to have any side effects?
We have some data going up to as high as 250 milligrams, particularly with patients who, not in her case, but certainly in some patients who are smoking, we know that the metabolism of erlotinib is affected. And so even in the package insert, it does include qualifications about how to dose increase up to 250 milligrams.
So speaking of older patients, let's finish out with your 90-year-old patient.
Yes, and this is an actual patient that we've been treating. He's a 90-year-old gentleman who actually presented with significant shortness of breath. On a CAT scan, he was found to have a large pulmonary embolus as well as a left lung mass. Further evaluation by PET revealed metastatic disease. He was actually admitted for anticoagulation, and one of his bony metastases was biopsied, and this revealed adenocarcinoma. Certainly in this patient, you know, we were not keen to wait a long time for mutation testing, and we did go ahead and start chemotherapy. And certainly at his age, we were hesitant, to say the very least, but this 90-year-old could probably run circles around me. And at the time, just prior to developing the pulmonary embolus, his ECOG performance status was ECOG zero. So in this patient, we actually gave him pemetrexed and carboplatin, and his disease has responded. And I asked him the other day, what was his performance status currently, if 100% was his baseline? He said at the time of diagnosis, his performance status was 50% of what he was, and now he's on therapy, he's back to 90%.
Did you say what the mutation status was? Did you get that back?
We did get that back, and everything was negative.
I meant to ask you before when you were talking about the patient with the mutation who then got chemo. I've heard it said that, or actually, I guess there's data that maybe chemo is more effective in mutation positive, but I've heard specifically pemetrexed. Do you believe that?
I think in general, you know, just looking at the first line trials, comparing the EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors to chemotherapy. Certainly, if you look at the survival of those patients do a lot better than the patients without the EGFR mutation, at least if you look by survival. Certainly, we don't, you know, have comparative, but looking historically, these patients do quite well no matter what they receive. Particularly pemetrexed, I'm not so sure. I don't feel comfortable to say that, you know, pemetrexed would be the drug to go to first line after erlotinib, but certainly because of the ease of administration, the less side effects with pemetrexed, certainly most of my patients elect to do that rather than other chemotherapies.
I guess actually, if you think about it, that LuxLung 3 trial that we were talking about before, the comparator arm against the afatinib was pemetrexed, cisplatinum, and I guess it kind of looked like what you might expect in general.
Right, right.
We've been talking a lot about mutations, and another report that came out at ASCO that I thought was interesting was this so-called SELECT study, a phase 2 one-arm trial looking at adjuvant erlotinib in patients with EGFR mutations, very controversial issue over the last few years. And that study reported a two-year disease-free survival of 94% with erlotinib. Can you talk about what your thoughts are about how to manage these people in general off-study?
Well, I think, you know, the data is certainly tantalizing using erlotinib in the adjuvant setting and particularly mutation-positive tumors. But I think, you know, we really need a larger trial to feel comfortable using this in the adjuvant setting. I think off-study, I certainly do still use chemotherapy. I don't feel comfortable using erlotinib because we really don't know when to stop the therapy. And, you know, we are subjecting these patients to side effects over time. And these aren't, you know, once every 3 weeks side effects for just 4 months. These are daily side effects for years.
So people always bring up the hope or wish that they had a phase 3 adjuvant trial to answer this question. Are we going to get that done?
Honestly, I would probably say it's going to be difficult. Unfortunately, we have not in lung cancer gotten to the point where breast cancer is being able to put, you know, thousands of patients onto a trial very quickly. And it's not quite clear why that is, but certainly I think over time people will be more likely to do that, at least to be able to get better answers, you know, for the EGFR mutation positive tumors, as well as certainly people want to look at crizotinib in the ALK translocation positive tumors as well.